Hey all, I'm here to talk to you today about machine learning on big data using Spark, Spark ML, and Spark R. And my name is Mike Lanzetta, and I'm a principal SDE at Microsoft in the Partner Catalyst team. We're a team inside the DX division that works with partners on projects that are not really out-of-the-box solutions for Microsoft. And in that context, I've had a chance to work with Spark and Spark ML and a little bit with Spark R fairly extensively. So I thought I'd come here today and tell you about those and a little bit about the solution that we've been working on in those technologies. So to give you an overview of what the session will entail, first I'll go into what Spark is, why you might want to use it, how it works, and some of the core concepts behind it. I'll then talk about Spark ML and go into details on the various transforms that it has, as well as the learners that it has, and give you an example of how you might use those together. I'll then talk a little bit about Microsoft R Server as a preliminary to talking about Spark R. The two cooperate when you're using HD Insight, so it's important to understand both of them and how they interoperate. And then finally, I'll go through a walkthrough of a scenario that we have in our project, so you can kind of see all of these pieces in action, or at least all of the Spark ML pieces in action. And then I'll close with a few best practices for working with Spark and some information for what the future might hold in the Spark realm. And let me know if I'm going a little too fast, if the translators start getting a little bit caught up. They don't have a way to flag me, so. So thanks very much. To tell you a little bit about what Spark entails, if you look at Spark, it is an open source parallel data processing framework for big data. And this may sound very similar to something like Hadoop, and that's because it is. Hadoop kind of came out of the realization that disk on these commodity servers that you had was cheap and underutilized. And so you had these commodity servers, and you could run these kind of large MapReduce jobs to compute results on large data sets. Spark took that one step further. They realized that memory was becoming cheap as well, not necessarily as cheap as disk, but cheaper. And running compute in memory is a lot faster. So you could take these Spark clusters, and you can run all of these large jobs on a large amount of data in memory, which made them blazingly fast. So that's kind of the Spark core engine. And they built a few APIs on top of that. So they have the Spark SQL API, and that basically is a way to interactively query your data, filter it, and aggregate it. They have the Spark Streaming API. That is for real-time streaming of your data, so real-time analytics and things like that. It's similar to streaming analytics from Azure, but it's on the Spark cluster. And then there's Graphx, which is a graph processing API in Spark. And that is for things like social graphs, where you want to ask questions like, who are the friends of my friends, or something along those lines. Similar to what you saw in the keynote this morning with Cosmos DB's Gremlin API. And then Spark ML, which I'll go into a lot more detail in this talk. So why might you want to use Spark? What are some of its benefits? The primary two that I see are performance and developer productivity. Performance because it's running all of its compute in memory, and it's scaling out across a cluster. So it's faster than Hadoop, but it also has the capability of handling more data than, say, your laptop, unless you have a better laptop than I do. And then developer productivity, that's really if you're using one of the languages that it supports, you can be very productive. I tend to do all of my data analytics in Python, or almost all. So for me, Python's PySpark support within Spark is very useful for me. And the fact that it supports Jupyter Notebooks makes it easy for me to do kind of interactive data analysis using Spark. Also, it has an ecosystem, both based on the fact that it comes from Hadoop, which gives it some of the Hadoop ecosystem, but also it has readers for a wide variety of formats, everything from Cassandra to MongoDB, which makes it easy to ingest data from a variety of sources and operate on it at scale in these clusters. So I mentioned Spark and Hadoop. How do they interrelate? Spark kind of came out of the Hadoop framework, and it ran initially on the Hadoop Resource Manager. That's what managed the Spark resources. And then eventually it ran on Yarn, which is Hadoop's newer resource manager. And it factored that out, so now it has its own Spark Resource Manager, and it can also run on Mesos. One of the byproducts of it coming from Hadoop is it doesn't have its own storage format. It leverages HDFS. And one of the byproducts of that is it makes it very easy to use on Azure, because web HDFS means that you can read directly from blob storage using the WASB format. You can read directly from Azure Data Lake storage using ADLS URIs. So it's very easy to ingest data from those forms into your Spark cluster and operate on it, and then write it back out to those locations. A little bit about Spark's performance. If you look at these results, we were running basically this 100 gigabyte of data. We were running a logistic regression on a 100 node cluster. And in Hadoop, that was taking around 2 hours. And the reason for that is it basically has to store all of its intermediate results on disk, has to do a lot of ingest, work on stuff, you know, write it back to disk. Spark, it was less than a minute. And the reason for that is every single node in the cluster reads in just the data it needs, operates on that data in memory, all of the intermediate results are in memory, and then when it's done, it writes out the results. And even on non-ML tasks, Spark is quite fast. So in 2014, it won the SORT benchmark, and it was 3 times faster than Hadoop. And the reason for that is basically not just the memory, because as you see, we're dealing with 100 terabyte data set size here. So that's much larger than the cluster had memory. But because of the fact that it was able to keep intermediate results in memory and do a lot of computation in memory, it made its general processing a lot faster. What makes it so fast? Well, if you look at a typical Spark workload, or a typical, I should say, HDFS Hadoop workload, right? What it's doing is it's reading from HDFS, it's doing some sort of operation, some sort of map operation, reducing, putting it back in HDFS, pulling it back up, doing more operations, putting it back. Whereas with Spark, it's basically just a single step, right? You read data in, it's in the cluster's memory, you operate on it within the cluster's memory, and only when you're finally done do you actually output data back to HDFS, which makes it blazingly fast. What gives it that architecture? Well, what we have is Spark has this head node that keeps track of all of the workers in the cluster and what they're doing, what resources are allocated to them, and how they're used. The workers themselves are capable of reading from HDFS and loading their data into their own memory, into their own cache, and they're also capable of operating on their tasks. When a program comes in to run against Spark, it creates a Spark context inside the driver, and that keeps track of what data the Spark program needs and what operations need to be performed. And it basically takes the program and it turns it into this kind of directed acyclic graph of computations and data loading and storing, and then farms that out to the workers. And so each worker basically knows what it needs to do and what data it needs to operate on, and then it just makes it go, and that's what it executes. And the workers get this done through this concept of RDDs, which I'll go into more detail in a second. Why might you want to use this? Well, I've gone into a little bit about the performance, but there are some workloads here that are useful for it. In one of our cases that I'll be talking about later, we really needed high-performance batch computation. What we needed to do is we needed to, several times a day, operate over a large amount of data in a very quick fashion, and Spark gave us that capability. And in particular, Azure HD Insight running Spark gave us that capability. I've already brought up interactive analysis. I tend to use this a lot when I have large data sets that someone gives me. I'll throw them onto blob storage, fire up a Spark cluster, load up a Jupyter notebook, and do analysis there and figure out what the data actually looks like. And that gives me the chance to work with these large data sets without trying to load them on my machine and watching my machine just fall over. Real-time processing. This is very useful for things like IoT scenarios or any scenario where you have data streaming into you. You can process it in real time. In practice, I tend to see actually streaming analytics work better in these sorts of cases, or even Azure functions work better in these cases. So the case where this becomes really useful is if you have an existing Spark cluster on premises or something like that, where it may be underutilized, then this can be something where you can really take advantage of that extra capacity by doing real-time analytics on that cluster. But in the cloud, there's usually better solutions for something like that. And then machine learning, which I'll go into a lot more detail. So there's a couple core concepts that you need to know about in Spark. And one of the most important is RDDs. And that stands for Resilient Distributed Data Sets. And that is the primary abstraction of data within Spark. And basically, they are immutable objects that keep track of where the data came from and what operations have been performed upon it. And the reason for that is, at any given point, if a machine goes down, as soon as it comes up or someone else takes over, that knows, where do I need to go to get the data that I was working with before? I need to go pick that data up, and I need to perform this sequence of transformations in order to get back in line. And the benefit of that is you don't need to replicate your data to other nodes in order to recover. You don't need any sort of like distributed consensus at all in order to recover. You just basically need to know what operations have been performed on this data and where it came from. And if you look at the set of operations that RDDs support, it's a very Hadoop style of set of operations, right? You have map, you have reduce, you have join, you have group by key. And one of the things that they noticed is that it was very difficult for data scientists to kind of wrap their brain around how to use these things effectively. They're used to thinking in terms of R or pandas and not in terms of these RDDs. So the way that you typically use these things, as I was mentioning, is you load them up, you perform a transformation which constructs a new RDD that has the knowledge of where that existing RDD came from and what transform was performed on it. You do that over and over again until you're done, and then you do some sort of action like collect or reduce in order to get the data back to the driver and do something interesting with the final result. But if for data scientists to use this effectively, they really needed a concept they were familiar with, and that's when Spark came up with data frames. And the idea behind data frames is that they can be created from RDDs, or they can be loaded directly, which really under the covers is creating an RDD and then creating a data frame on top of that. They're similar to data frames in Pandas or in R. Pandas is Python's data processing library, in case you're not familiar with it. It's basically Python's version of R's data frames. And you can actually convert from Spark data frames to Python or R data frames backward and forward easily. And so if you look at the set of operations that these have, they're very columnar operations, right? You're doing a select of a given column, you're doing an operation on that column in order to construct a new data frame with a new column based on that. You're doing a group by a given column. You're doing filtering on a given column based on some sort of operation against it, right? These are the sort of operations that you see there. And then, you can convert over to a Pandas data frame, which if you have terabytes of data is a terrible idea because it'll pull it all up to the driver and crash your system. So let's talk a little bit about about SparkML and what is entailed inside SparkML. It is composed of two different libraries. There's an older one, spark.mllib, which is in maintenance, but will be deprecated by version 2.2 of Spark. And the reason it's being deprecated is it was entirely RDD-based, so it was a little bit more difficult to use for these data scientists. And they came up with spark.ml, which is entirely data frame-based. So that's the one that everybody operates on now. It's not quite deprecated yet because you still need to occasionally devolve back to the old version. All of the models inside SparkML allow distributed training. So two things that points out. One is that they can operate on large amounts of data, but the other is there's fewer learners inside SparkML because everything that every model that gets into SparkML needs to be distributable, which can actually limit the number of models that are supported, and it takes longer for them to be implemented. It has a similar pipelining mechanism to something you've seen in like scikit-learn, where you can chain pieces together into a pipeline, and then you can fit that entire pipeline at once. And the reason you might do that is, A, it cleans up the code, but B, you can actually save out that pipeline and then load it later and use that for evaluation. And that will actually do all of the data transformation steps that are required in order to do the evaluation. So that tends to be the way people work with it. And there are several different data transforms and several different classifiers and regressors and other algorithms, and I'll go through those. The data transforms inside Spark ML, the main ones for text processing, there are a few for cleaning and processing text that you would recognize. So tokenization basically will turn a string into a set of tokens. Stop words will remove stop words from that token list. So common ones like a and the, et cetera. You can also define your own set of stop words. There's also n-gram lists. One thing to note is that a lot of these things don't have Japanese language support yet, which can be a stumbling block, especially for things like stop words. You can define your own set of stop words, but they don't have a default list for Japanese. So that's something to note. The other thing to note is one thing you won't see on this list of cleaners is any sort of stemmer or lemmatizer. So if you want something like that, and that basically, in case you don't know what that is, it's basically a way to tear off part of the word or turn the word into kind of a canonical form. So if you have something like train, training, trained, it'll turn it all into a common subword, train, basically. And that can be very useful for a lot of learning on textual models. And then there are a few transformers for turning text into features. Count vectorizer will basically turn these tokens. You define a vocabulary size, and it will construct that vocabulary and give back a count vector for the given tokens in your document set. Hashing TF does a very similar thing, but uses a hashing trick in order to avoid specifying a vocabulary. And basically, so multiple terms might be hashed into the same bucket. One side effect of that is count vectorizer is reversible. So you can go back, you can figure out what ID is mapped to a given term with count vectorizer, but that's not true with the hashing TF because multiple terms can be hashed into the same bucket. IDF is inverse document frequency that basically will try and figure out from a given document that you have what are the most important terms for that document overall compared to the rest of the corpus. So if you're looking at a whole bunch of tweets, for instance, which we will later, IDF will basically say, these are the most important terms in this given tweet compared to the rest of the corpus. They occur more often in this document than they do in other documents in the system that you have. And then word-to-vec is basically word similarity vectors and can be useful for clustering and other things like that. There's also a bunch of transforms for taking difficult data and turning it into less difficult data for learning. Two important ones, if you have a large feature space, our PCA will take a large feature space that may be linearly dependent and find a linearly independent set of features that it constructs out of that space. Chi-squared selector does a similar sort of operation, but instead of constructing new features, it basically looks through the data and figures out which ones are the most predictive and pulls those out instead. And you can basically specify how many of those you want. And that's a way to turn, if you have a really large feature space and you may not have enough data, you can actually turn that into a much smaller feature space of ones that are highly predictive. There's a few normalizers and scalers. Normalizer will allow you to do zero normalization of your data. That's useful for learners that might be confused based on the magnitude of the features you have. So if you have a learner that is learning from, say, grade point average and weight, it could potentially get confused by the fact that weight tends to be much larger and have a much higher variance than, say, grade point average. And so what you can do is you can use this normalizer to normalize them all between basically you know, around zero and then, you know, plus or minus one. Scalers will protect you against outliers. You can basically clamp your features. Bucketizer and quantizers basically will allow you to turn this kind of continuous data into categorical features that you can then learn from. And they just bucketize in different ways. And then DCT can be useful for learning from, say, audio data. It converts time series data into frequency space data. So if you do have audio data coming in, you could potentially train a model on a DCT converted version of that time series. And then there's a few other transformers that you should be aware of inside Spark ML. One is the SQL transformer. That will allow you to do arbitrary SQL transforms on your data, so you can construct composite columns, you can do filtering, you can do grouping within your data frame and get a new data frame back as part of your transformation pipelines. That can be useful. Another one is R formula, which allows you to give an arbitrary R formula as part of your transform, so you can basically define a predictive column within your transform based on a linear model. Hilariously, that's not yet supported in R. It's only supported in Python and Scala. So there's also a one-hot vectorizer. That turns a categorical feature into a one-hot vector. So if you're not familiar with what that is, so if you have a category, say, low, medium, high, a one-hot vector would turn that into, say, if you had high, it would be 0, 0, 1. If you had low, it would be 1, 0, 0. That's useful for a lot of different learning methods. They expect to have basically just these large set of float or integer features and not these categoricals. So if you have a learner that expects that, this is the way to convert it to do that. So let's talk a little bit about the learners that are available. One of the things that I mentioned earlier is that all of the learners in Spark must be able to run in a distributed fashion. And that basically means that unlike scikit-learn, where anybody can kind of add their own learner, it's tough for you to kind of add your own learner to Spark because it needs to run in a distributed fashion, which means that there are fewer learners available. So linear and logistic regression are obviously available. Those are the easy ones. And then there are a few different variants of decision trees, regular decision trees, decision forests, and gradient boosted trees. And those occur in both classifier form and regressor form. And I'm not going to go into any detail on what any of these algorithms do, mainly because then we would wind up in a machine learning course, and I don't think that's what anybody really wants. But it's very easy to use these. You'll see me use the gradient boosted decision tree later. You don't necessarily need to understand what's going on behind the hood in order to get benefit out of these things. And then there's the one versus all classifier, which is just another form of classifier, and a few other regressors that are kind of domain specific. For clustering, this is typically used when you want to kind of understand your data better. So k-means clustering will allow you to basically take an arbitrary set of features and kind of cluster them into various clusters, up to k clusters. There's a couple different forms of that. LDA, latent Dirichlet allocation, is a mechanism for topic modeling of textual documents. It can be used with other things besides text, but people typically use it for text. The idea behind it is that you run LDA and you can pick out what are the common topics that are important for this given data set. And then Gaussian mixture models can take an arbitrary set of features and fit a few different Gaussians to them. That can be useful for sampling. It can also be useful for data generation. And then finally, there's one collaborative filtering method in Spark ML. This is alternating least squares. It became relatively famous in the Netflix challenge. Which, as you may guess, means that it can help you build your own recommender systems. So if you need a recommender system at scale, you can build one inside Spark ML using ALS. So what does this actually look like in action? What does Spark ML code look like? This is what it looks like inside Python, PySpark. If you look here, the first line up there, let's see, can I actually point? Oh, I can. So the first line up there is basically reading the data from blob storage. And so you see the WASB URL, That's reading a set of JSON files where basically each line in the JSON file is its own document. And one of the elements in that JSON document is this column sentence, and that's basically the tweet. And so what I want to do is I want to take that tweet and I want to tokenize it. And so I basically build a tokenizer. And then I want to build these count vectors out of it. And so I build a count vectorizer. And so the tokenizer basically takes the sentence, it outputs words. The count vectorizer takes the words, and it outputs features, and that's basically the count vector. And you can see I want it to basically have a vocabulary size of 10,000, and I wanted to skip any words that only occur in one tweet. And that's what this min-df is basically min document frequency. And then I basically just transform the data frame that I have into a new data frame with the words. And then I fit the count vectorizer to that new data frame. And the reason I have to fit here is because it has to choose that vocabulary. So it chooses that vocabulary of 10,000. And once I fit, I immediately just transform that tokenized data so that I have the resulting features with the count vectors. And then I can basically construct this LDA. This is this latent Dirichlet allocation that I was talking about earlier for doing topic modeling. I say that I want up to 10 topics, and I say that I want it to iterate a maximum of 10 times. And then I just do fit, and that basically runs across the cluster, building topic models for all of the tweets in that data set. And that the result of that, I can say basically describe topics. I say I want the top three terms for any given topic. And then I can show those out. And what you'll see there is you'll see basically term indices. And you can actually take countModel.vocabulary and map those indices back to the terms themselves and get an idea of what's actually, what the topics are that you've pulled out of this LDA. So this is actually doing processing on millions of tweets across the cluster with these various models. And it's very few lines of code. This is all done within a Jupyter notebook. I just pasted it here because we have network problems. This is the same code, but done as a pipeline. So if you look here, the only real difference is I instantiate all of these up front, and then I basically put them into pipeline stages, and then I fit the whole pipeline at once. So that's really the only difference. So it's roughly the same code. And then how do we actually use this in practice? This is a project that we built on our team called Fortis, and we built it in collaboration with the UN Office for Coordinating Humanitarian Aid, or OCHA. And we use Azure functions to read from a variety of data sources and write of social streams, I should say, and write that data to blob storage. And we then have incremental Spark jobs, which run roughly once an hour. They'll spool up the cluster. They'll run, they'll tear down the cluster. And those do filtering, they do processing for sentiment analysis, and they do aggregation. And what they produce is they produce these heat maps, and they produce these trend lines. And the UN office, UN OCHA office, is basically using them to try and figure out what's going on inside Libya. They can't send anybody into Libya because it's too dangerous. So they use this to kind of figure out where to focus their efforts. They have very limited resources, so they can basically look at the results of this heat map, the results of these trend lines, and figure out what do they need to dive in on, who do they need to contact on the ground in those local areas in order to get more information and allocate the resources more appropriately. Right now, we're processing around 6,000 tweets and around 9,000 Facebook comments a second using this system. And like I said, that's all using Spark ML on this, what I was talking about, these high performance batch runs. Let's talk a little bit about Spark R. But in order to talk about that, first let's discuss Microsoft R Server. And the reason for that is if you're running Spark R on Azure, you're probably doing it in HD Insight. And if you're doing it in HD Insight, it comes with Microsoft R Server. So it's important to know what that gives you and how that works with Spark R. Microsoft R Server is basically 100% based on open source R. It runs all of your existing R scripts. It runs all of the CRAN code that you would expect. Operates just like a regular open source R server. But it comes with a lot of extra features. It comes with the Scale R package, which has scaled out enterprise-ready algorithms. And it comes with parallelized computation and no in-memory size constraints. So one of the issues that R has, open source R I'm talking about, is it can only run on a single thread, and it's bounded by memory. So if your data frames basically go past your memory boundary, you're out of luck. You can't do any analysis. Microsoft R Server solves that by basically inside the Scale R package, all of the RX algorithms inside there can operate across multiple cores. And you can also partition your data using RX DataStep to operate across multiple cores as well, using your own user-defined functions. And then there are no in-memory constraints because they have a new file format called XDF, which is basically a combo memory data, memory disk-based data frame. It's fast and scalable. If you look at generalized linear model here, in open source R, it's super linear scaling. It's actually really terrible. If you look at the RX GLM from Microsoft R Server, it's far, far sublinear scaling. And this is on a laptop. So if you were to take this to a machine in the cloud, like a beefy machine in the cloud, or a cluster, the results would be even better. How does that differ from Spark R? Well, Spark R has nothing to do with Microsoft R Server. That's basically, it's similar to how PySpark is Spark's Python binding. Spark R is Spark's R binding. So it has the concept of data frames. The Spark data frames are modeled very similar to R data frames. And you can convert between the two very easily. It has a model that's of interacting with these data frames that's very similar to dplyr. So if you are writing R code already, it's relatively easy to adapt it. So things like summarize, select, filter, things you would expect to use inside R on regular data frames with dplyr, you can now operate on Spark data frames across the cluster in a very similar fashion. It also has dapply and gapply and lapply for basically taking your own user-defined functions and running those across the cluster as well. It also has machine learning models in place. It has a more limited set than SparkML. So SparkML has a bunch of models, and they're gradually being exposed to SparkR, but SparkR is relatively new, so it doesn't have all of them. So check the documentation if you're looking for a particular model. It may not be in SparkR yet. How does it interoperate with Microsoft R Server? Well, like I said earlier, using HD Insight gives you both. All of the RevoScale R methods that I mentioned earlier are available to you. RX DataStep will convert a data frame into XDF and allow you to scale beyond the memory of the machine and allow you to do data transformations. And then there are these RX functions for doing learning across multiple cores. And those are all available to you in Spark R when it's running on HD Insight. And this is kind of what it looks like in action. I wanted to show you basically a comparison of the two. So what you're doing here is you're basically saying, I want a Spark cluster. I want to set the compute context. I want to read in some data. This is very similar to the other read that we had in the earlier one. But I'm reading in credit fraud data instead. And then you can run these logistic regressions. And you can basically run the RX version and train a model off of that. You can also run the Spark R version and train a model off of that. And it looks almost exactly the same. Really, the only difference is the RX logic takes the formula first and then the data. And Spark logic takes the data and then the formula. They're basically exactly the same. And then you can basically output the summary of the models. And you could save those models off to blob storage and load them later for evaluation. And in the case of the RX ones, if you train an RX model, you can save it out to blob storage and potentially load it up inside SQL Server R services. Although, to be honest, I haven't tried that going from Spark over to SQL. But in theory, if you're using the RX version, it should work. So how do you pick a language to use? It's really kind of up to your choice. So Scala, one of the benefits of that is that Spark was written in that, so it's always up to date. It will always have the latest features of whichever Spark system you're deploying. And there's no data marshalling penalty for using Scala. Basically, it's running in the JVM, and all of your data is in the JVM, so it doesn't need to be marshalled at all. Whereas if you're using PySpark or Spark R, PySpark would need to pick all that data in order to basically get it back and forth between Python and the JVM. Python is the second language that Spark chose, so that is always more up to date than R. And it's easy to use all of the existing Python modules that are out there. And it's easy to adapt your existing scikit learn code over to PySpark. Spark R, it's easy to use all of the R libraries. There are some great financial modeling libraries inside R that you can then leverage inside Spark on large data sets using Spark R. Are you familiar with the concept of Jupyter notebooks? Okay, I see a few head nods. They're built in when you're using HD Insight. If you look, when you deploy an HD Insight cluster, you get this cluster dashboards button. Click that, and you have Jupyter Notebook right there. You just click that, you can log in, and you have your Jupyter Notebook head. You can fire up these Jupyter Notebooks and do all of your interactive exploratory data analysis on the cluster from there. It's really easy to do. If the network was working better, that was my plan, is to actually demo off of that. But so here is code from our actual project. This code, we are taking Twitter data for tweets related to Libya, and we're trying to analyze that data and figure out what might be going on with it. One of the things that we've seen is a lot of the tweets related to Libya are useless to us. They're irrelevant, and one of the reasons behind that is basically whenever they mention Benghazi, they're basically mentioning it related to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or one of the various conspiracy theories involved in those two. They're not really relevant to actually what's going on inside Libya. So one of the things that we want to do was build a model that allowed us to filter out all of the irrelevant tweets. So we start by basically doing the data prep, and that involves something very similar to what you saw before. We're limiting to English language tweets for now, and the reason behind that is because we're using English language stop words. We add stop words that are relevant to Twitter on top of those. We do tokenization, we do stop word filtering, do the count vectorization, and then we fit the count model and transform. This is all similar to what you saw before. I just have a few more things in there in terms of stop word removal. Then we have data that's been labeled. This was a really painful process involving teams of interns where they basically did this semi-supervised learning process to figure out what tweets were relevant and what were irrelevant. They would go through and they would look for tweets that had a given term, like Hillary, for instance. They would label those as irrelevant. They would train up a model. They would figure out which ones had been tagged irrelevant in that model, but it hadn't been tagged in the data set as irrelevant. And they would basically find out, are there new terms that also trigger, that also say that this should be irrelevant as well? So basically, anything that Donald Trump would tweet is irrelevant. And so about 30% of the tweets were relevant in this case. And so we train a model to predict those. And the way that we do that is we have this inverse document frequency that we construct here based on the raw features that have been output by the count vectorizer. And that outputs a column called features that can be then used by the model to predict. We fit that model to the counted data. We transform to the IDF scaled. That gives us the features. And then we can use a gradient boosted decision tree classifier to do a binary classification based on the labels that we give it. We do an 80-20 test, train test split, and then we fit the model. So this is actually doing a lot of machine learning work in a very small space across a large amount of data, across, you know, basically gigabytes of Twitter data. And at the end of the day, what we have there is we have a gradient boosted decision tree that can effectively predict whether something should be discarded, whether a tweet should be discarded. And we can then evaluate that result. The way that we do that is we transform the test set so we get the predictions and the labels out of it. We construct a metrics object in order to get out the area under the precision recall curve and the area under the ROC curve. And one thing you'll notice here is that I'm calling .rdd, and the reason for that is because these metrics objects are still in the old library. They're still in spark.mllib. So you need to basically go from data frame back to RDD. But it's a very inexpensive operation. It's just .rdd because all of the data frames underneath are backed by RDDs. And then I can print the results. And here's where it gets kind of weird, is now if we want to actually plot the results, plotting doesn't really exist inside Jupyter Notebooks for Spark when you're running kind of just general cells. And the reason for that is that general cells are actually running on the worker nodes. They're distributed across all the nodes, so plotting doesn't really make any sense. You need to get that data from the nodes locally in order to plot it. And there are a few ways to do that. One way that I'm showing you right here is you use a SQL query in order to pull that data back. So what you can do is you can take any data frame and you can turn it into a temp table. And then you can basically have, you can do SQL queries against that. And there is a way in Jupyter Notebooks, in Spark Jupyter Notebooks, to do a SQL cell using this bit of SQL magic. And what that does is it'll do a query and store the results into a pandas data frame locally. So you can use that in a local cell and do actual work against that. And you can see that here with a local cell. We have a local cell here. We tell it we want to do some matplotlib work. And then we're using sklearn or scikit-learn to do the actual ROC bit. And from there, we just figure out what the ROC values are and we plot them. And so this is a way to basically do exploratory data analysis on your data in the cluster. You can build up these data frames. You can do arbitrary things to these data frames. You can do arbitrary modeling. And then with the result, you can do a SQL query to pull that back to local and then do plot it out and do interesting data analysis locally without leaving the cluster, basically. So that's really all I had for the Spark ML bits. There are a few things you should know, though, as best practices when you're using Spark. One is when you're using RDDs or data frames, you should be careful when using cache or persist. And basically, the reason for this is if you have a long series of operations, what Spark does is the worker nodes keep track of what data they need locally in their cache and then purge it in an LRU fashion. So if early on in that chain you have a data frame or an RDD that you're planning on reusing later in a different context, you should cache that by just doing .cache, and it will stick around in the cache, and it'll purge other things first, so that when you reuse that, it doesn't need to recompute it. And that can be very effective and can make your things perform a lot better. So that's just one quick tip. And then you can use unpersist to get that out of the cache. You don't necessarily need to, since it generally Spark does a good job of unpersisting these things, but if you've told it to explicitly persist it, it's useful to tell it to when you can explicitly unpersist it. The other thing is .collect is the way that you get a data frame back to the driver node, back to the head node, and that can be very expensive depending on the size of the data frame. So if all you're doing is trying to figure out, is this sane, and what I'm doing producing data that I expect to be producing, .take and .takeExample are much more effective. You give them a value, say I want 5 records or something like that, and it'll just pick back a few records and you can print those out. It's a lot more effective. The other one that I wanted to call out specifically is using broadcast variables. If you have static data, like when we were doing sentiment analysis, we had static data for basically what's the sentiment of given emojis. And we would store that in this dictionary that we then use a broadcast variable to distribute out to all the worker nodes. So if worker nodes fell and came back, they would always get that data back because it's a broadcast variable. And it goes out to all of them simultaneously, and it goes out at the beginning, so they don't need to fetch it like incrementally, and it never gets removed from the cache. And there are a few things specifically on Azure to be aware of when you're using HD Insight. The first is you should try and use a consistent storage container when you're using Spark, and basically a consistent storage account and a consistent storage container. And the reason behind that is you can store your results when you're done with a session, you can store your notebooks, and then when you fire up a new cluster, you'll get those back because it's pulling from the same container. Which leads me to my next point. When you're done with a cluster, you should tear it down because all of your data should be stored in this container, and all you're doing is paying for a computer you're not using. So tear that down when you're done with it and spin it up when you need it. The other thing is, if you keep your cluster up, if you still need it for some reason, but you're done with a given Jupyter notebook, don't just close the tab. Tell it to stop the kernel, because only when you stop the kernel does it stop paying for that compute. Basically, it's taking up resources in the driver for a kernel it doesn't know that no one's using. So that's an important thing to remember when you're dealing with that. Most people just don't worry about that since they tear down the cluster anyway, but it's something useful to know. And then where do I see Spark going in the future? The things that I see happening with Spark in the near to medium term, one is Spark R and Microsoft R Server having tighter integration. Spark R is relatively new, and our acquisition of Revolution Analytics is relatively new, and we're kind of committed to making the two operate effectively together and making them even more compatible and making the combination be best in class if you're doing distributed R work. I also see support for deep learning in Spark become a real thing. Right now, there are a few libraries out there for doing deep learning in Spark, but it's kind of few and far between, and they don't really work all that well. I definitely see the common kind of standard toolkits that you would expect, the cognitive toolkit, TensorFlow. I see those coming to Spark. I don't have any word from the team. Like, I haven't talked to the CNTK team to see if it's coming. I'm just betting on that because it's just so important. And deep learning, you know, with batch normalization and things like that, it really lends itself to distributed compute. The other things I see are more language support. And this is not computer languages. I think they'll probably stick at those three. But human languages, so Japanese, Korean, things like that, I see those coming. If you are open source developers or you want to become an open source contributor, I'm sure they would love to have you pull request for support. I see more text transforms coming. They really need a stemmer. I see that coming. And I see them expanding out the number of learners they have. For instance, they don't have any sort of SVM support right now. I see that expanding. The last thing here, and I will make sure this presentation gets out somewhere that you guys can all access it. There are a few getting started links. There's getting started links on our site for HD Insight and our server on HD Insight. There's the Revolution Analytics RevoScale R documentation. And then there's documentation for SparkML and Spark R. And then the Fortis project that I mentioned earlier is out there on GitHub. So if you just look for Catalyst Code Fortis, you should be able to find it out on GitHub and find the various Spark jobs that we have there for doing aggregation. This presentation will be recorded and broadcast on Channel 9, I believe, so you should be able to revisit it. And then Microsoft Virtual Academy has several interesting links. So thank you very much for your time.